Psalms 1. Happy are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked, or take the path that sinners tread, or sit in the seat of scoffers, but their delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law they meditate day and night. They are like trees planted by streams of water, which yield their fruit in its season, and their leaves do not wither. In all they do, they prosper. The wicked are not so, but are like the chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish.
In 1553, a mason named Peter Witsis was on trial in the city of Leeuwarden. Here's from the court transcript. Question, what is your name? Answer, Peter Witsis. Question, how old are you? Answer, 27 years. Question, are you rebaptized? Answer, I know of no baptism. I was baptized once, and that according to the teaching of God. Question, how long ago? Answer, about a year and a half. After giving these answers, Peter was put into a dungeon for an hour, taken out again, and asked, Peter, won't you change your mind about this? You see, Peter had been asked to change his mind about baptism, because Peter lived in a time and place where every baby was baptized, and so Peter had been baptized as a baby. But as an adult, and after much prayer and scripture reading, Peter had concluded that God was not so much interested in baptism being something that one does automatically when one is born into a so-called Christian nation, but rather that baptism is something that one chooses for oneself. And so, at 25 years old, Peter had been rebaptized. For him, though, it was his only real baptism. But for the state rulers, it was a second baptism. It made him what they mockingly called an Anabaptist, a rebaptizer. But make no mistake, this was no laughing matter for the state. Not baptizing your baby meant not registering your baby for their oppressive taxation, and it meant declaring that your allegiance was to Jesus over and above the state. That you believed that following Jesus meant that you might sometimes have to protest against, even disobey your government. And so Peter was under pressure to renounce his adult baptism. But he refused. And so he was condemned as a traitor, and he was executed. But before he was executed, Peter sent a brief note out to his wife. The entire note, his last words to her, all of them were these. Referring directly to Psalm 1, he wrote, "My dear chosen wife, abide in God and mingle not with the wicked, for if the righteous draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him, says the Lord." And then Peter finished with, "The time of my departure seems to be nigh. May it take place with God. When the hour of parting comes, fear not, but guard your lips. My dear wife, abide in the grace God has given you." In 1544, another man referred to as an Anabaptist had been on trial for the same thing. His name was John Kloss, and he was on trial in Amsterdam with an old man who everyone called Grandfather. He too refused to renounce his adult baptism. He too stood up to the government and said, "I follow Jesus, and that means I don't follow you if what you require of me is not what Jesus calls me to do." In fact, he had even been printing books that supported this so-called Anabaptist movement, books by a guy named Menno Simons, the guy that we as Anabaptist Mennonites today eventually got our name from. And John also refused to apologize for printing Menno's writings. And so John and his old friend, who everyone called Grandfather, were executed too. Their heads were chopped off. But before he died, John wrote his wife from prison too, and like Peter, he too quoted Psalm 1. He wrote, "An affectionate salutation in the Lord to my beloved wife, persevere with a firm confidence in the Lord, for happy are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked, or take the path that sinners tread, or sit in the seat of scoffers, but their delight is in the law of God, and on God's laws they meditate day and night. In 1576, Hans Bret, another Anabaptist, was arrested in Antwerp. An Englishman serving as a servant in a Dutch home, he went to answer the door one day and noticed that the person on the other side of the door was already trying to pry it open. He warned the rest of the household, also Anabaptists. They all tried to run out the back, but were caught by officers who were waiting there too. Hans was thrown into a dungeon for 8 months before finally being dragged out before judges and asked whether he too had been baptized as an adult. Hans was not ashamed to confess that he had followed Jesus' teaching to do so, and so he too was sentenced to death. But Hans was an extremely talkative guy. Before being imprisoned, he was known for spending all of his non-working time out and about the town talking to people about the Bible. While others took a Sunday afternoon nap, apparently this guy was prowling for conversation partners to talk about Jesus with. And so, on the morning of Hans's execution, the executioner did what was done to even quieter Anabaptists of that time. He screwed a piece of iron, otherwise known as a tongue screw, to Hans's tongue, so that Hans couldn't preach on the way to the stake. Then he loaded him into a wagon, brought him to a hut made of wood and straw, chained him to a stake, and it was set on fire. But while he'd been in prison, Hans also managed to get a number of messages out to his loved ones. Consistent with his talkative personality, he actually wrote a number of long letters. One of those letters to a friend, Hans also called on Psalm 1. He wrote, "O my dearest brother, weary not in the ways of the Lord, neither become slack in keeping God's commandments. Have your delight therein day and night with all God's righteous ones, and say with the prophet David the very kind of thing it says in Psalm 1, Lord, thy word is a greater comfort and joy to me than all the treasures and riches of the world." Peter Witsis, John Kloss, Hans Bret. For those of us worshiping in churches like ours that are built on the spiritual insights of these fierce Anabaptist Christians and many other women and men who worshiped and died with them, we have three men in the midst of speaking their final words to their loved ones, reaching into Scripture and telling their loved ones to pay close attention to Psalm 1. Psalm 1. You know, it's an interesting choice for these three. We don't know how Peter was executed, but we know that John's head was chopped off, Hans was burned. Their lives, like so many Anabaptist martyrs, were ended by chopping and burning. So it seems a little strange for us to find them in their final moments telling their loved ones, "Before I go, one last thing, pay attention to Psalm 1. Psalm 1, in which the central metaphor is one of a tree. The faithful, it says, are like trees planted by streams of water, which yield their fruit in its season, and whose leaves never wither. Everything they do prospers." Now, to be honest, if I'm one of those Anabaptists in prison awaiting my fate with a sword or fire, I'm not sure Psalm 1 makes my short list. "Oh Lord, I'm so scared," I imagine myself thinking, and then hearing, "Don't worry, just read Psalm 1, because of your faith, you're like a tree." What did a little chopping and fire ever do to a tree, right? But these three Anabaptists apparently didn't see it that way. They read Psalm 1 already knowing that they would be defeated by that sword, consumed by that fire. And they read about that tree planted by streams of water, and they said, "Yes, I choose to be like that." Which is to say, when they read Psalm 1, when they read Psalm 1, they were not thinking of trees or bodies or lives in the limited way that we see them now. Because to refuse to recant or disown their beliefs, to willingly go to the stake, as vulnerable as a tree is to flames, is to say, "I believe that beyond what we can see in this limited and broken world right now, there is something that we cannot always see. It is a stream of living water. so powerful that whatever seems to happen to me right now, I remain a tree, living by that mysterious water that continues to feed me beyond what is visible to us right now. I not only remain, but even if I am reduced to ashes, I stand tall as one who puts my faith in the hope that I will still bear fruit in my season, that not one leaf on my branches will ultimately wither. Now, without a doubt, these Anabaptist martyrs were thinking in part of heaven, of an existence with Jesus beyond their earthly deaths. But to simply reduce this to an equation for getting to heaven would be trite. It would be too disconnected from God's interest in this world. And so in addition to saying that these Anabaptist martyrs lived for an existence that they could achieve by passing into the next world, let's also take note that these Anabaptists lived for an existence that could possibly exist in this world. What was the existence in this world that they lived for? Well, the flourishing tree that those early Anabaptists believed in when they went to the sword and stake, that tree lives on today with us in this room. The believers who are part of a movement that refused to be chopped down or burned up. The believers in a movement that survived those flames and continued to bear fruit season after season for about 500 years now. You see, when asked to recant their convictions, this choice, the choice those early Anabaptists had was this. They could give up hope that their spiritual roots that they were sending down into the soil were actually being fed by living water, and they could recant and save their lives, or they could somehow believe courageously from their hard-worn spiritual insights that they were being fed by living water. They could believe that by refusing to recant their beliefs, they were preserving roots that would nourish a tree that would go on living beyond their earthly lives. They would choose between tearing up the roots that had just begun growing for them or allowing the ashes of death to fertilize those roots and nurture even more growth. Many of them chose the latter. And so one of the things that I want you to invite me to join in this fall is to get to know those roots in adult Sunday school, starting someday, September 8th. I have a note here that says, please see your bulletin for more details. I'm going to cross that part off. I want us to study these roots, and I want us to ask together, bringing all of our various insights, what makes these roots so worth it? As Christians trying to live in God's story and live as God's people today, what makes these roots so worth seeing and continuing to water today? Now, to be clear, here are some things I'm not planning we'll do while exploring our roots. I'm not planning we'll do this in a way that elbows out all of the spiritual wisdom of those of you that are here from other denominational backgrounds, or personally still feel most comfortable under a label like non-denominational when pressed. I want us to know and live our Anabaptist roots well, but I also want us to remember that fully knowing Jesus means always remaining open to learning from other people's roots, too. I want us to, secondly, I'm also not planning to teach you that the early Anabaptists were somehow perfect Christians that we need to just be like exactly and uncritically. They were humans like us. They were products of their time, like us. They could be self-righteous and condemning, like us. They could be wrong sometimes, like us. As with any look at one's roots, there are ways in which we should be inspired to be more like our roots, and there are times when we need to learn to look at the mistakes and untangle some things that have gotten caught up in those roots. I truly hope we'll do both. Finally, especially given that we've started with stories of martyrdom this morning, I'm not looking for us to beat each other up by using these stories to make one another feel guilty or inadequate. For far too long, Mennonites have had a tendency for doing that with these stories, for using stories like this to shame one another. In her essay, Writing Like a Mennonite, Julia Spicker Kasdorf recalls the way that the stories of Anabaptist martyrs were used to teach her to be silent and submissive. She remembers being sexually abused as a child and thinking, well, that's not so bad. That was just my body. Only later did she realize that the way she'd been told these stories had contributed to a false and condemning belief that it was a Christian virtue to allow herself to be abused, to not speak up, to not make waves. So I invite us to study our roots with the posture she later discovered in life when, to conclude that same essay, she wrote, "The tight-lipped survival strategy of my childhood is no longer useful. In the martyr stories, I now see not submission and silence, but men and women who spoke with their words and with their bodies, who refused to hold their tongues or keep the peace." In other words, when we study or sing words like, "Blessed be their children's fate if they, like martyrs, should die for them," a line from the hymn we sang now, let's make sure also that our children, for example, know we're saying, "Blessed is anyone who stands and speaks up for what they know is right," not, "God is up there just hoping you'll endure abuse or killing so that you can be the ultimate Christian because of it." So with those things in mind, I once again invite us to ask, what are the incredible roots of ours, and what do we have to learn from them today? To give us all a taste, and because I know that we're not all going to be in that Sunday school class, I'll suggest that some of its essence that we should carry with us into the coming year and beyond is this. As inheritors of a tree planted close to living water, we are people whose roots help us to remember a faith that the world is truly groaning for right now. We live in a world where Christianity has come to be associated with power, violence, colonialism, individualism. We live in a world where the message of Jesus has been so twisted that many people around the world have concluded that a Christian is someone who tries to control others with guilt, manipulation, and political power, is the most enthusiastic supporter of the American military, is the greatest opponent of immigrants and refugees from around the world, and, among many other things, the one who believes that his or her wealth is a blessing from God and that outreach is about simply saving souls without worrying too much about systems of oppression that keep people poor and broken. We live in a world that, to be honest, has some pretty good evidence to support these conclusions about us. But I know that we're gathered here today because we're not so sure about all that. We're not so sure that the world around us has been getting Jesus entirely right. And you know what? That makes us much like the Anabaptists who went before us, women and men who weren't so sure about a church in their time that forced people to become Christians, perpetuated the oppression of the poor, and used military violence to keep power and expand an empire around the world. Despite the 500 years that separates us, we're not unlike the Anabaptists. We're living in a time and place where Christianity has come to be associated again with wealth, power, and violence, and we're saying, let's open up the Gospels and see what Jesus really says about stuff like that. So as we study together in our upcoming Anabaptist Essentials class, and as we simply continue to move forward as God's people together, may we look at the Gospels closely. The gospel that showed our ancestors that discipleship is about more than just praying the right words in order to get to heaven. It's also about actually following Jesus into the hard places of this world, caring for the sick and the oppressed, and bringing healing to violence and redeeming relationships. The gospel that showed our ancestors that the Bible is not more important than Jesus, rather, Jesus is the one we read the Bible through. The Gospels that showed our ancestors that Christianity does not teach us to blindly obey our governments. Rather, it shows us that we must worship Jesus instead, which means we refuse blind loyalty to government. We stand up for those the government might exploit sometimes, and we refuse to be threatened. The Gospel that showed our ancestors that faith is not just about a personal relationship with Jesus, though it's that too, but it's also about being Christ's body together, actually learning to know and love one another intimately through Christ. And the Gospel that showed our ancestors that faith is not about Christians conquering non-Christians in battle, it's about following the one who conquered evil by laying down his life in love. Because my friends and loved ones. To paraphrase Psalm 1, for you in a time of need, blessed are those who don't just follow the trends of the time or take the path that everyone else is on, mocking the outsiders or those who ask critical questions. For the trends and the mockery are really just chaff in the wind. In the end, they blow away. No, blessed are those whose delight is in the law of God and the gospel, meditating on its challenges whenever they get the chance, day or night. They are like trees planted by streams of water. Whether they see it in their earthly lifetimes or not, they yield their fruit in its season. Their leaves never wither. Their roots become strong and give life for all eternity.